How long can I stay?
An hour.
Are you kidding? Do you think they're really watching Edie's apartment?
No, but we've put too much in now to have it go wrong for something so small.
An hour.
Turn out the lights.
Can't believe you had me followed.
Turn out the lights.
Welcome back to Logic Gate. Today we are discussing Season 2, Episode 5, which is entitled, I Have Friends Everywhere. As always, I'm your host, Scott, and I'm joined by my good friends,
Jason
and Doug.
And we are really raring to go and talk about this, I thought was a great episode. Let's dive right in real quick. I'll cover the Clea plot line. There was quite a few plot lines. I was actually going to note that. A lot of TV shows, they kind of have an A and a B story. Like, some have a C story, but, like, there's, like, literally, I'm looking at my notes here, there's six different plot lines going on in this show, just in this episode. So we see Clea in her shop. She's listening to various stations on her radio, so she's still scanning the radio for, I assume, there are other rebels out doing missions other than just Cassian. Luthen walks into the shop and notes that you're up early, noting that, you know, so I don't know what it is, 6 o'clock in the morning. So Clea is very diligent about her radio listening. I did note that her radio has a turntable. Did either one of you guys note that? Like, it kind of looks like a cross between like a turntable and a CD player.
It's like a CDJ.
Yeah, it's like very old school kind of.
Digital CD turntable things.
Do you feel like she was about to drop the bass? Or?
I mean, I would listen to, you know, Clea if she was doing some EDM. I'd sign up for that.
DJ Clea.
Nice. She's on the radio and she's monitoring Skuldin, who is, I don't even remember what the kid's name is, but it's Mon Mothma's daughter's father-in-law.
Davil Skuldin, yeah. I think he's like a Trump analog, sort of like a
rich,
political figure.
She's concerned because they being Clea and Luthen, or the rebels, I suppose, have a listening device under the table that at their compound, I suppose. So she's listening and she hears Skuldin talking about how there were some artifacts that were not authentic. And so he is now concerned and is looking at getting everything that he owns recertified, re-auditing all of the history of all of their pieces, because he's, I assume, an art collector of some sort. So this raises Clea's concern, because if you look closely enough at this table, you'll find this microphone, then he'll realize he's being listened to and all sorts of problems can ensue. At one point, Skuldin's buyer, I guess, comes into Clea's shop, and she's looking basically to buy new artifacts, and she's actually talking about how they're re-auditing all of their pieces, which has triggered Skuldin to send her out to find new pieces. So this is like now doubly concerning for Clea, because she's definitely very worried that they're going to find this listening device. There is... the lady that comes in mentions a Tinian Codex and a Corio Chalice, which they have determined are forgeries. So neither one of those names resonated with me, but I did write them down in case they come up later. But so they have identified a couple forgeries in their collection. Luthen is kind of overwhelmed at this whole scenario. Clea has not a whole lot of patience for Luthen. I think she's worried about her own stuff. She doesn't have time for Luthen to be emo about whatever Luthen stuff is going on. And Clea mentions that there's a party that's coming up and that her and Luthen are going to be there, and they want to remove the microphone at the party before they audit all of this stuff. So that's the Clea plot line. So do we know at this point why the rebels, or why Clea at all? Why are they monitoring Skuldin? I mean... Does he have...
I mean, that's Luthen's, I think, his main source of power and his connections. Like, he's able to, like, listen in. Clea is the one kind of listening in across the galaxy, I think. She was kind of scanning different frequencies, and she, you know, happened to listen in to Skuldin talking about the forgery. But I think this is like part of
talking about what?
The forgery, you know.
Skull. Okay.
And so.
But they planted a listening device here, so they're expecting him to be doing something like.
No. This is a listening device at the Mothma residence. So,
no, okay. No. The one she's listening to is at Skulden's.
Yeah, because it's at they're he has artifacts in his collection.
Yeah, so I think this is Luthen's operation. Is he has listening devices all over the place, and this is where he's able to get information. And
so, who is Skulden? Is he a senator? Why listen to Skulden is my point. Like, does he have information that Luthen could blackmail him with or whatever? He's not a politician.
No, I think he's just a higher up, oligarch of in the structure. Think of him maybe as like a Bloomberg. Maybe he ran for office. I don't know. With another rich guy, maybe even an Elon Musk or just somebody who has a lot of money,
right.
Power, and can get a lot of what they want done in a fascist system like that.
I would also point out that if he is getting a lot done in the current system, which is a imperial fascist system, it means he probably has connections, ties, is able to grease the wheels with the Empire.
Absolutely,
which
yeah.
You would probably want to know that sort of information.
So he's just a guy that's in the right position. We don't know specifically he's running drugs or prostitutes or any,
Yeah.
We know from season one that he's into some shady shit.
Yeah.
That's about as far as they go with it.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I would say this is a weak point, and we don't know enough about him to, like...
I don't know that we need to know a lot about him.
I would like to see especially his relationship with the Empire, because without a doubt, he has, like a relationship with the Empire. If he's able to do anything and operate the way he does, especially doing shady operations, or at least, providing cover for money laundering and the stuff Mon Mothma is wanting to do. So yeah, I would like to see more of that just to get that angle.
Fair, but it's not his story.
Right.
That's like saying Boba Fett was one of the most interesting characters in the original trilogy. But it doesn't mean that I need a whole movie dedicated to Boba Fett. A TV show for
that
matter.
Yeah, would you sign up for the Davos Skulden spin-off show? I mean, that's
maybe. Maybe down the road that could be something like...
That would be great.
I mean...
A spin-off of a spin-off of a spin-off. Like,
what if
Tony Gilroy's like, you know whose story hasn't been told? Davos Skulden.
We need to go deeper.
Davos Skulden, a.k.a. what if Han Solo was a rich dick?
Yeah, okay.
Sure. Yeah, but it is an important part, a structure of a fact, because really what he's trying to communicate is a fascist structure and like the realities of a fascist structure. And part of that is private corporations and private individuals with lots of wealth working, oligarchs. So I would like to see more of it, but yeah, fair point. You can't do everything, for everyone.
Well, we're going to be here all day if we don't move on. Jason, do you want to talk about the Cassian plotline so I'm not talking the whole time?
Sure, yeah, okay. Cassian is getting ready to go to Gorman, and he goes to what looks like a little shop and argues with a lady and gets a bag, we see, and he leaves. And as he's leaving, he's listening to what seems like a secret identity that he's going to assume. When he's on
Gorman. He basically gets this radio out of the bag, right?
Yeah.
And then they give him a secret identity of Varian Sky, who is a fashion designer.
Yeah, that's cover story for why he's on Gorman. But his real mission, of course, is to reach out to the Resistance there and see if there's any value in bringing them into the budding Rebellion Alliance. Sorry, I didn't mean to step on you.
No. All I was aware of is Luthen knew something was going down on Gorman and just wanted to get a sense of it. But we see him go there and get approached by the Gorman rebels, or the one of the Lady Gorman rebel people in a cafe, and he's kind of dresses her down a little bit, tells her that she's making a lot of mistakes. He could be anybody. He could be working for the Empire,
She walks in and calls him out. She's like, "Oh, I haven't seen you in a long time." And he plays along, but then he gets her to sit down and he basically tells her, he's like, "You're being sloppy. Like, you're not a good rebel. You got to keep this on the down low."
Yeah. And so it's it's very cool. So this whole him arriving on Gorman with the outfit, I mean, he's looking freaking drippy, you know, and he's showing his training. This is actually the first moment that I actually appreciated him as an actor. I didn't really see what Tony Gilroy saw in what's his name?
Diego Luna.
Yeah. As an actor. I mean, he's a cool, you know, he's a cool, good looking guy, but he's very unassuming, kind of looks really young for his age. I haven't been super impressed with him, but seeing him like assume this identity and kind of show his skills as a infiltrator, as
his,
a rebel.
His spy craft really shines through in this.
You get some real good spy craft in this
episode.
I don't
know if that's good writing or good acting or both, but like, yeah, he definitely shines in this as far as blending in and interfacing with the Gorman rebels.
And as he gets older, he really has an interesting look to him, like with his slick back hair and stuff. I saw a video of him in the Criterion closet picking out movies and stuff, and he kind of dressed similarly drippy in there. You know, side tangent, but yeah, I'm starting to become a Diego Luna fan this far in. So yeah, anyway, he later visits Caro. He's sort of the head of this Gorman front, the older guy. His shop, his clothing shop.
It's a Twillery.
Okay. And he says they sweep for listening devices all the time, daily, and everyone does it, so it's not, I guess it's not suspicious.
Well, what he says I thought was interesting. He says it's a competitive market. So he has his shop swept for listening devices, not because he's worried about the Empire listening to him, because he's worried about his competitors stealing his spider silk ideas, apparently. Or maybe that was a cover, I don't know. But I thought it was interesting that he plays it off, that it's because of his competition.
Yeah, that makes sense. So Cassian gives him like this code crystal as sort of a bond or like collateral, it seems like, to give them on his side, which seemed important, or at least they thought it was impressive. And then Caro tells Cassian they know that they're building the armory. We'll find out how they found out later through Cyril, but they understand that the building that's in their courtyard, or at least overshadowing, is indeed an armory, and they have an Imperial informant. And Cassian is very suspicious. He says this is what the Empire does. They feed false information. So he's hesitant to like help them out. He knows they're sloppy, and we kind of leave it there with that. He still has to like verify the information, basically.
I think it's worth noting that the Gorman rebels, they're kind of pushing Cassian for more information. They want to figure out what's going on with these shipments. They're pretty confident there are weapons on these shipments. And they want to, I don't know, if hijack or take out one of these incoming ships that's full of weapons in public, so that they can call the Empire out on their BS and say, look, dude, you're bringing weapons. You told us this is not what you were doing. We know this is what you're doing. They want to create a scene. So they're trying to find a shipment that is full of arms.
And if I'm not mistaken, Cassian basically says, that's stupid. That's a stupid plan. You guys are being stupid.
You don't have the resources to take out a heavily armed military ship. Right.
He basically says, no, this is dumb. You should not follow through with it.
But like at the end, I think he says something like, you're not cut out for this or something. And the other guy.
Can I, not to cut you off, okay. So what happened? So Cassian tells him that he was like, you can't hijack this ship and steal these weapons and then live here. You can't hijack these weapons and then stay at the scene of the crime. That's ridiculous. And Caro, the leader of the Gorman front, his response is, not much of a revolutionary, are you? And tell your friend I'm not impressed. So, the Gorman front is expecting Cassian to come in, you know, guns a-blazing, tell them how to blow the Empire out of the sky, and Cassian basically tells them, you guys are dumb, you're going at this way too aggressively, you need to be more nuanced.
Why? Why is Cassian taking that approach? Why is that his opinion?
I think because they, being the rebels, don't have an organized force. They don't have the body count to affect these military-style operations they want to do.
I would also point out, a year earlier, he saw what happens when you have a disorganized rebel force.
Sure.
They
were fighting in the jungle.
Lack of leadership. They come to blows against each other. They end up playing five hands to the death.
Right.
I mean, he's seen what disorganized, untrained, undisciplined soldiers, for lack of a better term, are capable of. And he's seeing that same discipline, lack of discipline here on Gorman. That's why he's so much against it. Like, you guys suck. You're going to get in over your head.
I don't blame him at all because, yeah, just the very limited interaction he's had with these Gorman Front's people has been underwhelming. They're raring to go, and Cassian is trying to roll them back and say, you need to be smarter about this.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting. I think a prediction, it would be interesting to predict what happens. So, like, Cassian, I think, ultimately is going to find out that their informant, who their informant is, or at least he's going to find out that the information they're getting is shady. The Gorman Front is most likely going to go through with it anyway, I think. And so,
they're so
what do you
aggressive.
Think is going to happen?
There? They're not going to listen to it. Because, I mean, the closing line is Caro basically calling Cassian a pussy, right? Like, okay, I'm going to do whatever I want to do. You're not going to back me.
Revolutions are messy. Yeah. And the whole mission of the Empire is to make their groups look bad and do the wrong thing. And what they're trying to do is appear to be doing the right thing and get people on their side. So how are they going to make that work? How is Cassian going to figure all this out and make that work, you know, in their favor? So I'm very curious. I think it's going to happen. Obviously, it's got to have some sort of climactic thing happen.
Well, I mean, for sure, he doesn't see the whole big picture, but his instincts are onto something. Because, yeah, attacking a shipment is exactly what the Empire wants them to do.
They're falling right into it. Yeah.
And again, it would be one thing if you attacked the shipment and then get the heck out of Dodge. You know, sure. Like you'd steal these weapons and go to some other galaxy. Maybe you could get away with it if you were trained. But you cannot just attack this ship and then stay right there, right?
Yeah.
The only other thing I noted on this plot line was at one point Cassian talks to, I can't remember who it was, somebody in one of the crowds, and he's asking them about the Gorman, I don't know, when all those people died. And what his explanation was that there was a peaceful protest, or there was a group of about 500 people gathered in the town square or wherever. And Grand Moff Tarkin was coming in on some sort of ship, and he wanted to land, and he asked them to disperse so he could land his ship wherever he was going to. They were protesting. They refused to disperse, so Tarkin essentially parked his ship right on top of these 500 people. So they're pissed off. The Gorman people are ticked off from a long time ago because Tarkin cold-bloodedly literally parked his ship on top of their people.
I didn't catch that. I didn't know it was just like parking the ship. I thought it was
I don't know if he literally crushed them or the thrusters killed them, but the point was Tarkin's ship killed 500 Gormanites.
I didn't catch that. The bellhop's dad died in the massacre. So that's why he was telling him.
That bellhop, he's cool.
Real quick, I'll cover the Bix plot line. We see Bix at home in her apartment on Coruscant looking all depressed and emo because Cassian's not there to talk her off the ledge. Ding dong, knock on the door. She goes over the door. Who's there? It's Luthen. Bix immediately freaks out because she's assuming Luthen has come to tell her the bad news that Cassian is dead.
Do you think that's it, or is she also wondering if she's about to get Tay-Kalmud?
I thought that at first, too, but, I mean, Luthen's immediate line was, whoa, calm down, it's okay, he's fine, he'll be home soon, and then they circled it. So if you're Bix, you're literally twiddling your thumbs in that apartment with nothing to do, your boyfriend is off on this super secret mission she doesn't know about, and his boss shows up at your front door essentially in the middle of the night, I would probably be thinking the worst, too. But I'm sure there is definitely a sense of that also, that she's also later worried about he's going to take her out. Luthen mentions that back in the day he spent some time in their apartment. You know, again, it's more of a safe house than an apartment, but it's owned by the rebels. So he looks around and he was like, oh, I remember staying here. He mentions to Bix, he knows that she has a drug problem, and he mentions that he wants to work with her, but he needs her to be healthy. So he knows that she has some skills that he could leverage as part of this rebellion, but he's looking at her going, hey, lady, you're a drug addict. Like, you got to get your act together. if you want to be involved in this. And so he calls her out for doing drugs. And Bix says, I use it for sleep. And I wrote down, said every drug addict ever, right? Like, I'm not really addicted to, you know, whatever this drug is. I just use it because I can't sleep at night. And I did note that she watches Good Morning Coruscant on the TV. So, again, she's got nothing to do in her apartment. So she's literally watching Good Morning Coruscant.
Daytime, yeah.
Yeah, TV. Watching daytime TV to get the news. She's got a gun in her hand. So she's literally watching TV with a gun in her hand, and she's bored out of her mind. That's all that's going on with Bix in this. She's still struggling.
I hope she has a bit of... I know she's going to die. I'm pretty sure she's going to die. But I hope she has at least a recovery and a heroic moment later on, and then she dies. Not just, you know, fades out, and because she's in a sorry state. So, I don't know. We'll see.
Okay. You're saying she dies because she's not in any of the other Star Wars properties.
I think they're setting her up to die,
too. Well, I don't know for sure, yeah.
Okay.
But she's in a relationship with Cassian.
Mm-hmm.
We see later that Cassian is not in that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
She's nowhere to be found. You would think she would have been at least in his vicinity if she was still existing.
And what would be better motivation for Cassian than the rebels killing his girlfriend and making him even more engaged with the rebellion? That's hypothesis. That's the
dramatic thing to do. It is kind of obvious, but... And Tony Gilroy doesn't always do the obvious thing, so who knows? I think Doug knows, but...
The next plot point was Gorman / Palmo. Do you want to cover that? You want me to?
So the Cyril
part of it? Yeah, the Cyril stuff, yes.
Cyril. Well, I can do, like, the first part, I guess. So the ISB raids Cyril's office as he's talking with his mom and says he's going to come home. He's got a meeting with Deirdre and Partagas in person. And so the ISB interrupts, coming to his office looking for a bug. They indeed find a listening device. Cyril plays it off like he doesn't know. But he does know,
He does?
Well, he suspects. Yeah, he knows he's been listened to by the rebels.
They break into his business or his office, I suppose. They tell him they're looking for a listening device. Cyril objects. He was like, whoa, dude, I'm on your side. Why are you coming in here disrupting all of my stuff? And they essentially arrest him and haul him away so that they can look around the office, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, and they interview him for hours or something that.
I mean, this is just more super deep spycraft because we know that Deirdre's running the ops and that she's using him as her guy on the inside to go infiltrate the rebel forces. But to make it look as authentic as possible, local ISB has no idea that that's his mission, and they actually suspect him of being a sympathizer.
Oh.
So okay. Deirdre is telling him, hey, they're going to come raid you because they think you're... with the rebels. And he's like, oh, okay, I'll get on the phone with my mom real quick to make it look innocent.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he puts on a great show.
I didn't put that together. Okay.
Of apparently we bugged ourselves,
He was like, why would I bug myself? Yeah, he made a big point to make a scene that this is stupid. We don't even trust ourselves, right?
Yeah, so he's really enjoying his
It's kind of an interesting juxtaposition. Since the very beginning of the show, we've seen the growth and progression of both Cassian and Cyril, and they're both showcasing how they've really come into their own as masters of spycraft.
Well, I'm a little bit confused because part of this scene, after they haul Cyril away, it cuts to the rebels. They hear the ISB coming into his office and they shut down all their devices real quick so it can't be linked back to them. So is there more than one listening? Are the rebels and Deirdre listening in?
No, it's just
the rebels are listening in to the ISB arresting him, and they're going, oh, this dude is legit. We can absolutely trust him. Look, he's getting in trouble with his own people.
And he got fired from his corpo job. I mean, he's a loser. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So they're leaning into this guy being...
But that's exactly what the Empire does. They will feed you information.
Ah, okay. All right.
It's subtle. It's not immediately obvious. They're not holding your hand with all this kind of spycraft stuff. It's great. I mean, they don't treat you like... a kid when you're with this storyline. Because especially, for a minute, I thought Cyril might actually join the rebels. For a moment, I was wait, he's getting into it. But then I thought, oh no, that's not Cyril. He's fascist through and through. Like I, you know, maybe for a half second I thought that, but
I don't feel like he has a redemption arc where he flips on the Empire.
Not at all. I don't think so. That's not how this works, but okay. So I'll go up to like when he goes to Coruscant, but before that he does talk to the rebels for a bit and they think he's a great informant. And so Cyril... Well,
the one thing that's interesting to note is the Gorman Front gets Cyril's official record. So they get his paper file or whatever that says he was fired from his corpo job, like whatever. So they're, like you said, they're leaning in. They realize this guy might be compromisable. So they confront him. They confront him in the alley, essentially, right? When he's walking home, they're after they've got his paper file. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. He's basically telling them what they want to hear. And so he kind of agrees. The Gormans want to find out if the Empire, what they're building in on Gorman, and they want to confirm it's an armory, which would give them something to go to the Senate and also unite the local rebellion. Cyril agrees to get them the information. So he copies data.
What do they want from him?
They want the, you know, the transport. They want
the shipping manifests of what's coming in on these ships because they're looking for weapons because they want a ship that they can hijack. So they have, I don't know, 30-second, 60-second conversation about getting these shipping manifests. And it was like super interesting, good spycraft. I wrote in my notes that only Tony Gilroy can make shipping manifests sound interesting, right? Like normally that would be super boring, but they like, we want to see what's on these ships. We want to know what's coming in.
Right. Yeah. So he drops off the intel to the spider dude, the merchant who keeps giving him spiders. And the Gorman rebels find some info about the MSR, the military security required carrier. So that is proof they are making an armory. So it's legit info, right? Like we can assume this is legit information.
I did note that Cyril Burns, you know, gives them a disc of some sort, a physical, looks like a CD kind of thing. Like I thought that was a cool analog throwback. And the Gorman Front actually, they look through the files, like you said, and they're happy with the, they actually marvel at the level of detail in the Empire's record. You know, that's a very kind of Nazi thing to do, is to like have these like stellar records of, you know, every single transaction and down to, you know, the individual boxes kind of thing. So the Gorman Front is looking at all this data going, oh, this is great. We can really use this against them because there's so much detail there. Should we talk about Daedra real quick? Because her and Cyril's plotline sort of interact here.
Well, then he goes to Coruscant. Go ahead.
So Cyril goes to Coruscant, but he's only allowed to be there for a short amount of time. He goes to their apartment, his and Daedra's apartment, and Daedra's hair is down. Have we seen Daedra with her hair down before?
I'm not sure, actually. Yeah,
I mean, like when Cyril's mom came over, it was up in a bun. Most of the time, she's very well put together, and he basically catches her kind of like relaxing and her hair is down. I just noted that her hair is down and she looks less imposing. He's only allowed to stay for an hour, or I think Daedra tells him that he's anyway, because Partagaz insisted that he be followed. So when Cyril walks into the apartment, Daedra makes him turn the lights off. Like it's sort of a big deal that he's home at all.
I assume the turn the lights off, Cyril, is code for let's get it on.
Okay.
Let's get it on time. It's business time.
You know what? You never know with those guys. Like
that was clearly their sweet talking and like let's turn the lights off now, Cyril. Turn the lights off.
That is so hot.
Business time?
Yeah.
It's business like time.
Team building 1999.
Cyril takes his mom. So he's only allowed to be with Daedra for a short amount of time. Cyril takes his mom, one of those fake spider. I don't even know. Are they real spiders? Whatever. He takes his mom a spider gift from Gorman, and his mom looks at it and goes, oh, perhaps I'll call it Cyril. And
his mom's a bitch.
Daedra and Cyril meet with Partagaz to discuss the Gorman front. They're basically setting up a double cross where they will continue to feed the Gorman front correct information, but the implication is that eventually they will feed them false information, and then they can, I assume, use that to figure out who the leaker is.
Okay.
Yeah. But for now, they agree that we'll continue to give them correct information so that the Gorman front leans more into things.
That would make sense. I didn't quite catch that, but that makes a lot of sense for them to, like, at the last step, maybe get them like a false transport that has like no weapons on it to make them look really bad. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. So. Yeah. I mean, didn't that happen in World War II? Like after we cracked the Enigma code, like we knew where the Germans were going to be, but we couldn't. If all of a sudden we moved all of the boats out of that area, then they would know that we were listening to their communication. So we and the British, like, we had to send these ships that we knew were going to get destroyed, you know. Now, I think that was a plot of that. What was it called? Anyway, it's a plot of one of those movies. What do you do when you have that information?
Benedict Cumberbatch movie?
Yeah, exactly. That's I'm trying to remember what it's called. Something game. Anyway.
Imitation game.
But the point is that what do you do with this information? You can't just immediately act on this information, or your enemy is going to know that they're being listened to and change how they operate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool.
I did write down that as they're discussing with Partagaz, Cyril says, I gotta say, this is the greatest day of my life. He was very excited about, you know, being involved in this potential spy craft.
This ain't no rebel in the making.
Right.
It's because cream in his pants.
And also, his spy craft is nowhere near as good as Cassian's. Like, I mean, he's getting there, but he's a little too anxious.
I've been impressed with the way he's handled this situation. So. Yeah.
All right, so the last plot line is the Dakar plot line with Saw Gerrera. You want to talk about?
No, you can continue. Just finish it out.
We cut to Dakar, and we see Willman again teaching Pluty with like a kind of looks like a safe cracking style of machine. You know, they're turning dials. It's very analog. Pluty fails, and it blows up, or you know, blows up is the wrong word, but it you know it indicates
fails the,
a failure.
Like, test thing, yeah.
You know, it beeps or throws a red alarm or whatever. And Cassian says, Willman says, and we're dead. So he's trying to train Pluty to use this machine to create, I forget what it was called. But
the
it's
Rhydonium?
There you go. It's a very sensitive machine. And as Saw Gerrera pointed out, it burns your skin, it burns your lungs, it burns everything. So you have to be really careful with it. Pluty is overwhelmed. At one point, he talks to Saw Gerrera, and he was like, God, there are just so many parts and so many different things to memorize on this machine. Like, I don't know if I can get it all in my head. Saw Gerrera actually wants to take out Willman. He's talking to Pluty, and he says, hey, this Willman guy has seen too much. He was only supposed to be here for a day and train you. Now that he's trained you, if you're good, I want to kill him because he knows too much about our operation. Pluty sort of talks him off the ledge. He was like, yeah, okay, maybe, but there's just too many variations for me to memorize. Maybe if you could give me a little bit more about where we're going and what we're going to do with this, and then I would only have to memorize, you know, whatever, that particular scenario. And Saw Gerrera sort of relents, and he was like, yeah, okay, well, tomorrow night we're going to leave for wherever. I don't even remember. So Saw Gerrera... We think that Saw Gerrera is out to kill Willman, and he's feeding Pluty this information that nobody else has, but that's not what ends up happening. Willman says he's trained Pluty as much as he can, but Saw Gerrera ends up pulling a gun on Willman because, we think Saw Gerrera is going to kill Willman and have Pluty take over, and then... Oh, because he thinks Willman is going to traitor on them. And then at the last minute, he just points the gun at Pluty and just straight up executes Pluty right in front of Willman.
Mm-hmm.
So the implication there is that he knew that Pluty was an informant, and he was sort of feeding him false information to see if – to draw out of him that he was – that Pluty was turning on them. And then once he got enough information, he just straight up executes him. So that was full on, you know, Honshoot's first style. Like Saw Gerrera gave zero bucks, shot Pluty in the head, point blank, you know, like nobody's business.
But I would also point out in Rogue One, that's the nature of Saw Gerrera's character, is he is just uber paranoid, thinks that everybody is a traitor, even his closest people. Even the little girl that he raised in absence of her father is a traitor, come back to betray him. So him shooting that guy, to me anyway, by no means proves that he was working against Saw Gerrera. It just kind of highlights even more that Saw Gerrera is a loose cannon.
Agreed. I just took it because of the way he told that guy. He told Plutie, he's like, we're leaving tomorrow and we're going to wherever. Like, he feeds that information. Yeah. And then literally the very next scene is when he executes him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just assumed that, you know, he had leaked that information, which allowed Saw Gerrera to realize.
I think this is Saw Gerrera on his game.
Yeah.
He's still crazy, and you see more of that later, but like, I think this is all like well-crafted, you know, spy stuff where he's kind of suspecting Plutie, and I think he even puts it into Plutie's mind that he's going to take out Willman when you're ready, in order to force that sort of decision and force that to come up to the surface. So I think it's even more that he's sort of suspects him. I think he does find a recording device on Plutie after he's dead. He holds it up and he says, you know, traitor, you know.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure so whether or not that's real or not, but can we just like take a step back and appreciate the setup of this complicated device with, you know, how many variations, and we need to know, and then this Plutie guy demands to know, you know, one of the variations so they can know where it's going to go, which forces, you know, which forces this whole event to play out. I mean, it's just amazing writing to have a setup, have something, you know, this device that has variations for a reason, not just because it's complicated. There's variations because the different locations will tell you which variation you need. So therefore, you know, he can use that to force bad information to the Empire,
right.
And so on and so forth. Yeah, it's awesome.
And I think it's a masterclass in acting too, because Forrest Whitaker is really,
he's awesome, yeah.
Creepy, like driven and dark. I mean, well, number one, he straight up executes Plutie, but like you said, he does a very, in fact, there's a scene here where he's telling a story about being a slave on whatever planet he grew up on and working naked. So I can't do it justice, but he does a really good job of setting the scene. He was like, you guys think you have it hard? Like, I grew up a slave. I had to, you know, whatever, you know, dig in these fields naked for 20 years. And like, you guys have got it really good. He tells this really creepy story. Saw Gerrera does a good job. Forrest Whitaker does a good job of coming across as both driven and creepy at the same time.
Which I think, to me, yes, part of the scene is seeing what Saw and his crew are up to. But I think another part of it is experiencing it through Willman, who, while he has been involved in the rebellion, it's all been under the umbrella of Luthen. Everything is very regulated, very strict. They play by the book. This is not that. This is a more radical side of the rebellion that he's being exposed to. He's seeing the scoundrel side. He's seeing the shoot first, ask questions later
side.
He's
seeing the sausage be made, right?
Like, right.
He's seeing the dirty parts. And you got to remember, he didn't want to be there. His plan was, I'm going to be here for one day. I'm going to train your guy, and I'm going to get the heck out of here because you guys are toxic. You're going to get me killed. So now he's forced. He has to stay with Saw Gerrera because there's nobody else that can run this machine. He's seen Saw Gerrera execute this other guy. He knows Saw Gerrera is a loose cannon. It's, yeah, he's in a really tough spot right now.
But he's not disagreeing with any of it either.
Right.
In short, we're watching Willman get radicalized in real time.
At the very end, he takes off his mask. Were you going to go over that, the whole Rhydonium
part? Yeah, so
the
Saw Gerrera says, his line was, because she's my sister Rhydo and she loves me. So I wrote down that he loves Rhydonium a little too much. So I don't know if we learn more about this. Like, I don't know,
that was that story of him being the prisoner. They came across like the leak, and like everyone else ran and started getting itchy.
Oh, that's what it was, yeah.
But he stayed and like started, you know, I guess probably getting like poisoned or addicted to like
the Rhydonian. Well, that was going to be my next question. Is it kind of like a drug? Because I wrote down, he's a little too into it, you know? Like, he's like...
Well, it's like being addicted to like spray paint or something, where it's like not really a drug, but you like it a little adjacent. Too much, you know?
Because he just uses it to help him sleep.
He did everything exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. But then Willman takes off his mask at the end because...
They're wearing masks so that, like, that you don't breathe this toxic stuff in.
Yeah, there's like they actually get into the pipe and it starts working and that puff of smoke comes out and Saw goes over and like takes a big deep breath, oh my sister and all that. And then Willman kind of seems to be convinced by his speech and like takes it off and starts screaming in the wind or whatever.
He so howls.
Okay.
He's starting to get into Saw Gerrera's mindset.
I don't know.
And the last line that I wrote down as Willman is breathing in this toxic fumes or whatever, is Saw Gerrera saying, "Let it in, boy. That's freedom calling. Let it run. Let it run wild." So, like, Saw Gerrera is, again, a little too into this Rhydonium. And now, he's got Willman.
No, I'm sure he'll turn out just fine.
I'm sure it'll be fine. Yeah. I mean, what could be wrong inhaling a bunch of toxic stuff?
Yeah,
good so episode. I'll go real quick. I loved this episode. A lot of just low-level setup, a lot of spycraft. I don't know what else needs to be said. 9 out of 10. Great.
I hesitate to give this like a perfect score because I think this would be the episode I would give to someone to just say, like, as an example of Tony Gilroy's writing and, you know, Andor as a show and Diego Luna as an actor and Saw Gerrera or... that guy, I forgot the actor's name, but Forest Whitaker. Yeah. Thank you. Just and all the different plot points, like you were mentioning, there's so many A, B, and C storylines, and how they tie together and how they connect. So much information is put forth, but it also just it's provided smoothly. It doesn't feel forced. Just like I think it's maybe one of the best episodes of TV I've seen.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna give it like a 9.8.
Okay.
8.5.
All right. Fair.
This is a continuation of the last two episodes. Episode 3, I wanted some action. I wanted some payoff, and they gave me Mon Mothma getting drunk and dancing at the end.
And it sweet sucked. Dance music. Don't forget the music.
No, I hated that Mimos. Dance music. It sucked. DJ Clay could have spun something better. And then the last episode, while I conceded that you know, you're fast forwarding, you still have to kind of establish a foundation for where this 3-episode arc is going to go. There was still a bit of a lack of action. Same with this episode. Everything's building. There's a lot of tension. Brilliant writing, brilliant acting. I don't take away from any of that, but I want something to happen.
That is kind of Tony Gilroy's MO, though. Like, he's not known for being an action star. Like, if you look at, you know, Devil's Advocate, or you look at Michael Clayton, it's just like this. It's a slow burn.
Sure.
Right? I mean, is there action at the end? Yes. But the Tony Gilroy magic, you know, is all the little nuances that build up to that.
You're it's not so, wrong, but it doesn't change the fact that I want action.
I understand. Yeah. That's totally valid.
But it's what's important to you as far as like what you want out of a good episode of TV. Yeah, and that makes sense.
I will say, I mean, the worst episode of Andor is probably better than the best episode of 95% of other TV.
Oh,
just
for
the
sure.
way that it's written, the way they show, don't tell, the way all the plot points intertwine without being obvious. Like, all of that is just chef's kiss that makes this show and what Tony Gilroy does so great, right? The very, very few other shows do this. It takes attention. It takes work, I think, maybe to watch a Tony Gilroy show. Whereas if you're watching, you know, I don't even know, Big Bang Theory or whatever, you could watch an entire episode while playing Candy Crush on your phone and you wouldn't miss anything, right? I feel like when I'm watching even one of the lighter Andor episodes, if you're not paying attention in detail, you're going to miss a little tiny something that comes up later.
Yeah.
That's what I like about this, is there's so much meat on that bone. It's not surface level. Every little thing, I mean, background character, I mean, just all of that stuff all comes back and ties together and builds out this universe. The whole thing is fleshed out, not just the surface.
You're not wrong, but it is my score, and I'm sticking with it.
I'm not saying your score is wrong. No, I agree. Yeah.
I am saying Jason's score is wrong.
Oh, okay. Valid. All right. It's been a while, so we'll sign off. Logic Gate out.